The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. With our best ever Wi-Fi all around your home, your world is limitless. The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. Unlimited broadband so you can download, upload and stream as much as you like.
Most of you listening this morning will know Alistair Campbell, a British writer, communicator, political strategist, mental health advocate whose career has taken in journalism, politics and everything else in between. His new book, Living Better, How I Learned to Survive Depression, is a deeply personal account of how his depression has affected his life, but also how he's learned to live better despite it. And he joins us this morning. Alistair, you're very welcome to the programme. And the first thing I'll say to begin with is how I was struck by the tone of the book. Made me feel like I was eavesdropping on a session between you and your psychiatrist.
Well, that's very, very good that you say that, because I actually took a copy. The first person I took a copy of the book to was my psychiatrist. It's the guy called David Sturgeon, as you know, and I do feel he was a very, very important part of me getting to a much better place with my depression. And I think, you know, one of the reasons I wanted to write the book is I'm now 63. I think it's taken me a long time to get to a place where I have learned to live with it, even though I still get it, and even though it can still be very, very crippling and brutal. And I hope that if people are out there who are struggling, that they don't take as long as I did to face up to some of the things that you need to do. And, you know, I've included in the book some of the, literally, you're eavesdropping some of the stuff that we talk about, because I've included a lot of the things I've done with him to get me to a better place.
Just dwelling on the psychiatrist piece for a moment, you speak in the book about the importance of getting the chemistry and trust right between psychiatrist and patient, because I suspect a lot of people have went to a psychiatrist, they like a bad date, it didn't work out, and then they went off and didn't ultimately address the problem.
Well, one of the things I really like about David is that even when he's putting me on this medication or that medication, he never ever says, this will do the trick. He says, look, this is always trial and error. I don't know if this is going to work, but let's give it a go. And the other thing, it is about chemistry. And I think people should, you know, keep going. It's inevitable in life. You know, you'll have guests on your program, and some of them you like more than others. Teachers, you know, whether they like to admit it or not, they have some kids that they like more than others. And it took me a while to find somebody that I really, really trusted. And I really do trust David, and he's become a very important kind of guide in my life. And I don't name some of the others, but the one that, for example, when I went to see him and he said he was worried that maybe, you know, the press would be sort of hacking emails and eavesdropping, and therefore he should give me a code name. And he called me Abraham Lincoln, which I don't think was very good for my I'm not sure. Given that one of my constant refrains is that I've never fully achieved my potential, I'm not sure that was a good thing to do.
You know, you mentioned medication there, and you talk about your psychiatrist or whichever one it might be, and the frankness of your story separates you from the, I suppose, the tone in which mental illness is dealt with, and mental health, I should say, is dealt with, and particularly depression. It's still, is it not, and you'll tell me because you know, is it still a sense of taboo, a sense of stigma, a sense of, I better not say it because I'll be reduced in other people's eyes?
I think there is, and I think that's one of the reasons why I've talked about this for a long time, as you know, but I think doing it in this way and being, as you say, completely frank about it and about what it's meant for me and for my family and for my partner and my kids and my parents and everything else is just to say that there shouldn't be that taboo. And, you know, I make the point in the end of the book that cancer used to be a taboo. We used to call it the big C because we didn't want to talk about cancer. The fact that we now talk about cancer, people don't feel ashamed, they don't feel they have to hide it, that has helped people who get cancer. And likewise, I want to try to do the same with mental health, that nobody should feel any more strange about going to see a GP because they feel they've got depression, or they feel they've been hearing voices, or they've got OCD, or whatever it might be. The first step is to admit you have the problem. That is the first step to trying to deal with it. And I took years of decades trying to pretend that I didn't have a problem. And it was only when I really started to admit I had a problem that I could begin to deal with it.
Did denial feed it?
Definitely, because what denial does is it makes you feel worse about it, because you absorb the feeling that this is not just not right. You know it's not right because you're not feeling right, but it also adds that almost that moral dimension that this isn't right. It's not right that you feel like this is the wrong way to feel. There is something wrong with you, and that feeling is then what inhibits you from saying to somebody else, "Do you know what? I'm not right. I don't feel right. I need help." And I think that what's been interesting is like, for example, Fiona, my partner, we went for years where I would just say, "No, I'm fine. Leave me alone. Stop nagging me. Why are you asking me if I'm okay? I'm absolutely fine." And now that I'm very, very open with her, she's got better at dealing with it from her perspective as well. And likewise, I mean, I think a lot of our children's friends, you know, they sometimes sit around when we're talking about stuff and they say, "God, you know, it's amazing the way you guys just talk about how you're feeling all the time." But it's helped all of us, I think.
There's often a sense of like a spectrum when it comes to depression, and because it became, when mental health became much more talked about, you felt some people might have been possibly, this might be very cynical, jumping on the bus in a way. And if you're in the spectrum, so you go to work on a Monday, you've got what I call the blues. And then, you know, some days you might have something horrible happen in your life and you become very down, if you like. In Ireland, we have the expression, she took to the bed or whatever. Now, at the other end of that spectrum is a person who feels like they have a foot on their head and they're being pushed into water, and or a foot on their throat. Proper, to me, depression. Do you believe in that spectrum, Alistair? And because I know you have your 1 to 10, and maybe talk us through both.
I do believe that because, you know, if you just... one of the things I want to campaign for is for people to feel they can talk about their mental health the same as we do our physical health. Now, if you stop somebody, you bump into somebody in the street and say, "Hello, mate, how you doing? How you been?" Now, that is sort of a question about your life, but it's also a question about your health. And you might say, "Oh, well, I've got a bit of a cold." Right. "You got a bit of a cold," or, you know, "Oh, I've been having a terrible problem with my back." Now, we don't think there's anything odd about saying that. But actually, it's just the same for our mental health, that we don't feel the same every day, and we don't feel the same every part of every day. So I have this thing where when I wake up in the morning, a lot of my depression is dictated by how I feel when I wake up. And if I wake up, if I feel, I've given myself a number for that feeling, and if I, one is kind of deliriously happy, 10 is actively suicidal, and if I'm straying beyond 5 into the 6, 7, 8 territory, I start to worry, and then I start to do some of the things that I've learned to do to try to get my health, my mental health, in a better place. Now, I'm not suggesting that we should all go around that every sort of small talk becomes about our mental health and well-being. But actually, I think in the workplace, for example, particularly now with the strangeness of COVID and all the sort of weirdness that we've all had to live through, I think actually starting that question with not just how you're doing, but how you're feeling, is actually not a bad place to start a conversation these days. And I think if we can feel that we can be open about it, I think that first step to talking is a really, really important step.
Now, I wouldn't have had you out as one for the gratitude list.
Why not, Ryan?
I think I get the impression you're a rather testosterone-fueled chap who wouldn't be into that sort of thing that belongs to other people.
Well, may I say, despite having met you many, many times, I think that is very dangerous stereotyping. No, I think I am well, put it this way. I think it's important that we all try to be grateful and try to express gratitude for the things that really matter. And I think that it's only when you do that kind of thing, and that is one of the exercises that I did regularly with my psychiatrist. When I was feeling bad, he would say, "Okay, you're feeling bad. Let's push that to one side for a minute. Tell me the things you feel grateful for." And once you start to list them, you actually, it can help to lift your mood, you know. I mean, if I think about during the COVID thing, and, you know, it was weird for everybody, as I say, but actually I did start to go out, you know, going out for a walk with the dog became like a, "God, this is nice. Listen to the bird song, seeing the trees and all that sort of stuff." So once you actually start to say, "I can be grateful for that," and then when you get into your relationships and, you know, the fact that the kids give you so much joy and your partner is so supportive and all this sort of thing. And then once you've kind of established that and you start to say, oh, God, you know, I'm really grateful for the fact I can play the bagpipes. I'm really grateful for the fact I love listening to Motown. I'm really grateful for the fact they've got a good bike. And it can actually, that can trigger a shift back up, if you like, back up the right end of the scale.
Yeah, it's funny, as one gets older, the sheer joy in what a younger me would have thought was mundane and taken for granted. You're in the same zone there.
Absolutely. And it's like, you know, that now look, listen, don't get me wrong, there was a period of lockdown towards the end of it when I had a really bad depression, mm-hmm. and there was nothing you couldn't get me to go for a walk, you couldn't get me to go and, you know, take those simple pleasures. But when I am in the mood to do that, then, you know, there's frankly nothing better.
When you see it coming, is it like looking at a horrible bus coming to take you away? Is it that obviously on the way, a slide?
It is that obvious, but it's not like a bus. It's more like a very slow and very kind of I've called it sometimes. It's like a, it's got a smile, it's got a look on its face, and it's got a bit of a feel of jelly. And it's not taking me away, it's coming to take me over. So it sort of comes in, it then just pours into my veins and takes me over.
Like a lascivious baddie in an old film.
It's not even like that, because it's not like, it doesn't, I don't give it a kind of human embodiment. And the other thing to say is it's not always the same, but the most common feeling is it's like this oval shape. It's about five times the size of a rugby ball. It's above my head, and it slowly comes down and it enters my head, and then it goes right through my veins. And before I know it, I can't get out of bed.
It sounds terrifying, but that's the whole point of your book, I suppose. And it brings you just on the gratitude list. And of course, I was joking with you about you not being that sort of person, obviously. The resentment list, which do you I'm not enjoy writing most, but is the resentment list helpful to get stuff off your chest?
Yeah, it is. And also, I think what I found helpful about that was the fact that after a while, some of the things that were on it, you thought, I mean, you don't really resent that. Therefore, the gratitude list was so much longer. And I think that I hope that for most people, they've got enough in their life that can be the case.
Yeah, so you know, sometimes when you're trying to do a crossword and you can't get anything and you go away and you come back and you finish it off in a jiffy. And I wonder sometimes if you write a resentment list when you're not feeling great, can you go back to it when you're feeling better and say, God, what was I worried about? Look at all that resentment. I don't really feel that.
Exactly. And actually, when I was writing the book, I really, really, really forced myself to do more, to make it longer. But in the end, I couldn't. It was just things that I said, no, I don't really resent that at all. I don't care about it.
Can we isolate an incident in your story, Alistair, which found yourself, you know, punching yourself in front of Fiona, and explain to us how did that come about and the impact of that?
The impact of it, thankfully, was that was the point at which I realised that I couldn't do this on my own. I had to get help. But no, what had happened was it was after I'd left number 10, so it was 2 years afterwards, I was still being pressured by both Tony Blair and Gordon Brown to go back, and I was getting gradually drawn in. Fiona and I weren't getting on terribly well, went out for a walk, and I just felt this kind of rage inside me, and I started beating myself up. I mean, you know, quite badly. I mean, like, you know, bruised eyes and throwing myself about, and you know, Fiona was just standing there looking terrified, and that was the moment when I realised that, you know, you've tried your best, you really tried to work this through on your own, you can't do it. And that was what led me to go and seek out David Sturgeon.
And you're back in the psychiatrist's chair then, and it was clearly a critical thing to do for you to stay on the straight and narrow.
I think so, and I think, as I say, I think it was really lucky. I actually was, again, he was personally recommended by a friend of mine who was already seeing him, and that, I guess, made me feel more trusting towards him. And it's back to the thing about relationships, is the minute I met him, I thought, this guy's okay. He's not saying crazy stuff. He's really listening. And I felt you know, and your dad was a psychiatrist, and I'm sure he will have had lots of patients who just, they stuck with him because they felt something very, very personal. It is an incredibly personal relationship because, you know, he literally, as I say in the book, you know, at one point he was asking me to record my dreams as I was having them or as I was waking up and writing them down and emailing him so as he could think about it for the next session. You go from not knowing somebody to talking about the innermost secrets of your life and your heart and your mind and everything. It's an incredibly personal relationship.
I still get letters, Alistair, from former patients of his to the show to say how important he was to them on the other side of the counter and at the desk, as it were, and how they wouldn't probably be alive or around without his, which is very gratifying as a son.
I'm sure it is, and I'm sure that, and I always think the reason I have so much respect for good psychiatrists is that, you know, the physical doctor who's got, you know, they can do blood tests, they can do X-rays, they can fix things, whereas all the psychiatrist has to go on is what they're seeing and what they're hearing. There's no, they can't sort of do an X-ray of the heart to say why you're feeling sad. They've got to probe away. They've got to try to spot patterns. And, you know, I say there's the at the time that we were doing all the dream analysis stuff, I mean, I've got to be honest that most of the time I thought this is just complete nonsense. It's a total waste of my time. But actually I started to see patterns and he started to see patterns. And that's when we sort of started to make progress.
Is it the case that both your brothers died at the age of 62?
It is the case, and I just beat them because I turned 63. The book was meant to be published in May when I was still 62, and it became a bit of a family joke that, you know, would I be the first to get past it? But yeah, both my brothers died young, but my older brother Donald had schizophrenia.
Yes,
and you know the combination of the very, very heavy antipsychotic drugs, it does take about 20 years off a lot of people's lives. And my second brother Graham, he was a very heavy smoker a lot of his life, very heavy drinker, and he lost both his legs in we all ended up leading pretty different lives, but I think we had a lot of similar issues.
Was it peculiar to celebrate your 63rd birthday knowing the importance of the age of 62 and your brothers?
It was, in a way, but I mean, partly because it became a bit of a thing within the family about, you know, oh my God, he's got 5 days to go, will he survive, and all this sort of stuff. But yeah, it's sad when you know when somebody loses the life young, and you know, and I still feel, even though I'm 63 now, I still feel very, very young. I feel young at heart, really, you know, to think that both my brothers have gone is not just sad, but I also think that, funny enough, particularly with my second brother, I feel that there was a lot of waste there. I feel he had an awful lot of talent and he just never made much of it.
Returning to your book, because when people go to the shop to buy your new book, Living Better, they'll see Living Better, How I Learned to Survive Depression, Alistair Campbell, but they might be struck by the colour scheme, and because it's blue and white and red, and one might think, oh, he's obviously a patriot, loves his country, loves his flag. Could you explain the importance of the colour coding of your book cover, please?
Do you know what? I hadn't even thought of that. The design, I love the cover.
Yeah.
And I think the design's brilliant. But I'm going to ask you now whether that is what it was about, because you're obviously referring to the fact that when I had my breakdown,
yes,
I became obsessed about the colours red and blue.
Yeah.
And the politics in my life. And I had that, no word of a lie, that had not crossed my mind until you said that just now. So to tell your listeners what that was about was that when I had my breakdown and I was arrested and hospitalised, I became convinced that I was part of some sort of, I'd been kidnapped for some sort of weird Thatcherite re-education program, and I had to go from being red to blue, and I had to go from being left to right, and I was refusing to do it. So, for example, if the doctor said to me, are you all right? I would say no, and I'm not going to be, on the basis that I thought he was asking me to become right wing. And likewise, if I saw red or blue, they just kind of completely freaked me out. And it's interesting, when I've mentioned this to other people, this appears to be quite a common thing.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sure your dad met plenty of people like me. Or maybe it's green. Maybe it's green and green. Yellow in there.
Maybe that'll be the cover for somebody else's book when it comes out here. Okay, before I let you go, because you like love talking about politics as well. Just a few observations, if I'm. Were you over the Phil Hogan resignation story last week, or were you too busy doing something else?
No, I was, and actually, I actually tweeted. A clip, the clip he did on RTE of announcing it, saying, you know, how refreshing it was to see somebody accepting responsibility, given that we on our side of in the UK have seen a succession of ministers and senior ministerial advisors like Dominic Cummings blatantly refusing to accept responsibility. So I thought it was sad in a way, because I think, as Ursula von der Leyen said, he's been an extraordinarily good commissioner. But I do think, you know, people have to take responsibility for their own actions.
Secondly, the new leader of the Labour Party, is he the sort of guy you want there, and would he kind of coax you back into the mainframe then?
Well, he's certainly better than the last guy, and I think he's done... I thought he was excellent in Parliament in his first few outings. I think he's done the right thing in terms of, you know, trying to sort out, particularly deal with the anti-Semitism problem that that arose under Jeremy Corbyn. And now it's about the policy agenda going forward. So he's definitely made a very, very good start.
And finally, Alistair Campbell, I'm completely wasting my time asking you what you think of Boris Johnson's handling of the COVID crisis. Probably am.
Well, you're going to be really surprised to hear this, but I think he's been an absolute disaster. Oh. And I think the reason for that is, I think both in terms of his character and his competence, he's not up to the job.
Thought you might say something like that. Alistair, it's always good to talk to you, I must say. Mind yourself, and thanks for your time. Congratulations on the book. It's wonderful.
Thanks a lot, Ryan.
Nice to talk to you. All about Alistair Campbell.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Joining us this morning. Bye for now. His book is called Living Better, How I Learned to Survive Depression. Like I say, it was like eavesdropping a session with a psychiatrist and an extremely articulate and insightful patient. And that's available in bookshops as and from tomorrow. The text number is always 51551.